Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
To episode 66 of The Hi-Lo, the weekly news and pop culture podcast brought to you by journalists Dolly Alderton and Pandora Sykes.
Hi, Pandy. We've got a bit of an end of term feeling. The rosé has been poured. This is the podcast episode equivalent of the teacher putting the DVD on, I think.
CJ's got a Peroni. Coasters, please. Everyone
oh, sorry.
Coasters.
Coasters.
Yeah, thanks very much. It was the finale of Love Island for everyone who isn't Dolly. And I went on to Undercover Lover, an unofficial Love Island podcast by the journalist Harriet Minter, to discuss all of the best themes, moments and thoughts of the series with the author Lucy Vine. You can download on iTunes should you want to listen. If Danny Dyer isn't a primetime host within the next 3 months, I will eat my cotton socks. Also this week, our new Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt has baffled everyone by referring to his Chinese wife as Japanese.
He must be very tired. Or a racist.
I don't know what it is. I did quite enjoy a tweet that was like, to be fair, our last Foreign Secretary regularly forgot he was married, because obviously Boris Johnson was subject quite a few affair rumours.
Speaking of bizarre, we had, I think, my favourite email the Hi-Lo's inbox has ever seen, which is from a man called Jerry, who wanted to book 6 rooms at the Hi-Lo.
This email was brilliant, as was Dolly's reply, where, bear in mind, Dolly was meant to be working on the Hi-Lo when this immaculately executed email came into my inbox. Dolly confirmed availability with Jerry for 6 discounted rooms as part of the Hi-Lo's summer bonanza deal. And then invented a signature where she called the Hi-Lo one of Condé Nast's top 100 hotels to listen to before you die. I wonder if he was looking for the Hi-Lo Hotel, which does, according to Google, actually exist in Oregon.
Does it? Oh, I was a bit sad, actually. I think Jerry was a bot because it bounced back immediately when I replied. And I was very efficient as the Hi-Lo's hotel booking system.
Also in the mailbag were lots of emails pointing out that I made a really careless error in the top line last week, which was talking about the devastating shooting in Toronto. I said that 15 people had been killed. What I actually meant to say, and I'm so sorry for not double checking, is that there were 15 victims, 13 of whom were in hospital and 2 of whom who died. Our thoughts are with anyone affected by the tragedy in Toronto, and I'm really sorry again for that careless error, and thank you to everyone who wrote in and highlighted it for us.
We had loads of interesting responses to last week's episode in the mailbag. Thank you to everyone who shared their stories of mental health, particularly experiencing mental health issues in childhood. Pandora and I found them really interesting and enlightening. And thank you also to everyone who wrote in with their thoughts on natural cycles and femtech.
We had so many responses which really chimed with a lot of people's concerns, including mine, about femtech and how it's quite dangerous to rely on it as a contraceptive at this point in time. This was an email we got from Izzy. There is such a lack of conversation and education around female contraception and sexual health in general in both women and men. Firstly, my father is a GP, and when we discussed natural cycles, he wasn't surprised to hear its popularity, but he also affirmed that this is an ancient technique and definitely not something new or revolutionary, or presumably 100% foolproof. Secondly, when I was discussing contraception with doctors almost 2 years ago, I am now 22, I was initially prescribed the implant but voiced my concerns about the amount of hormones. Then I was offered and agreed upon the copper coil, which is a hormone-free alternative. I feel like the copper coil is not promoted enough. It's a small copper coil, which is a natural spermicide. I honestly wish more women knew about this because it's so reliable and it can be used as emergency contraception 48 hours after unprotected sex. I have nothing to complain about it. Periods are at first heavy and uncomfortable, but now all is fine. It annoys me and my father that this method is not promoted enough. People are all still sticking with hormonal options even if they don't agree with them. Not that many people know about them, boyfriends included. And that's another annoyance to me, boys not understanding their girlfriends' methods. Mm. Alternatively, if a woman did not want her period all the time, there is the hormonal coil, which has about 1/8 of the amount of hormones as the implant or pill. As you can tell, contraception is something I'm really passionate about. And for me, the copper coil offers a safe and healthy alternative. Thank you so much, Izzy. You're right. I think that's really important. Lots of people I know are massive fans of the copper coil. I, in the past, have actually really liked the hormonal coil.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, with the coil, I've had friends that really extol the virtues of it and said it's given them freedom and changed their lives. And then I've had friends who haven't had great experiences on it. Sadly,
that's just contraception, isn't it?
It is case by case, and you have to find out something that works for you. And also, without sounding like a nun, there's only one way to make sure that you have 100% risk, you know, no risk.
Da, 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 da.
And that's not shagging.
Da, da, da,
and I recommend it highly.
Our 29-year-old virgin here in the studio today.
Anyway, let me tell you what I've been listening to and enjoying this week. I've been catching up on some brilliant episodes of Table Manners with Jessie Ware, which we've talked about on the podcast before. It's a really funny, really charming, really warm conversational podcast in which the fantastic musician Jessie Ware and her gorgeous mother have people around for dinner, and they talk about their guests' lives, but they also talk about their relationship with food, their history with eating and their family, what they ate when they were growing up. It's all about the kind of emotional and anecdotal and memory attachments to eating, and I just absolutely love it. I loved Tracy Thorne, who is just a great podcast interviewee. I talked about her a few episodes ago because I loved her episode with Terry Gross on Fresh Air. Paloma Faith was brilliant. She was actually very honest, Paloma Faith, which I applaud, about losing her baby weight. And there's this kind of quite funny mix-up that she told Jessie before she arrives that she's vegan, but what she meant was, I'm eating vegan to lose weight. So they kind of cooked this huge vegan banquet, and she was like, oh, I'm not vegan. But she's very honest about it, and I think, I don't know, I've got a lot of thoughts on this. I think that we can't pretend that this isn't a prison that loads of women are trapped in. And I don't think we should glorify it, but I think it's really important that we're honest about it.
It is really problematic. And when I had my baby, I was a stone more afterwards. I mean, I was 3 stone more before she came out, but I was a stone more.
Yeah.
And it wasn't being the stone more that annoyed me, it was not being able to wear any of my clothes because they felt like a really key part of my identity, and I hadn't been able to wear them for like 4 million years whilst being pregnant. I then lost my baby weight, but mostly through anxiety, if I'm honest. So I found it very difficult when people congratulated me on looking like I hadn't had a baby, because they were just looking at my outer casing, whereas the reason I got there was not necessarily anything that I would advocate or particularly admirable. So it is really problematic.
It is. And also, I remember being with you quite a lot after you'd just given birth, and people said it to you a lot. And they're trying to compliment you, and they're trying to make you feel like your old
but
self.
It shouldn't be the first thing we say.
It shouldn't be the first thing we say. And also, it's really the least impressive thing that a woman can do.
I know.
Being
slim. I know.
You know, what is impressive is that
she grew a baby and
made
this
baby. But so I'm very, it's something I've noticed actually, because I think I used to say it a lot as a way, you know, I'm such a blabberer anyway, I kind of just say stuff to fill space. But now I never comment on a woman's physical appearance. I'm actually even quite careful now when I notice that a woman has lost a lot of weight. It used to be something I would congratulate her on, and it's something I don't.
I think
anymore.
You just have to think, would you say the other way? Would you be like, you look great, you've put a stone on?
No. I think we just need to generally take away the onus from a thing that defines a woman is her physical
appearance.
What
about if you think a woman's been on like a hardcore diet and exercising loads and has really wanted to get to a place where she feels more comfortable with her body? I'm not saying she's very underweight. Mm. So it's not dangerous or anything like that. Mm. If you knew she was working really hard at it, would you say, well done?
Do you know, I would, but I'd say it privately. I think that's what I would say.
Right, yeah.
I think anything where you're having a group of people make their gaze, your body, the focus of their gaze, I think it's uncomfortable. And I think women have to do that every day anyway, which is why I'm so okay with women making dark jokes or speaking honestly about the kind of struggles that they have with being enslaved with these kind of pressures of beauty standards, because that is the truth of our fucking existence.
I'll take a listen to that podcast, because she's actually been really interesting on all sorts around motherhood. She's spoken a lot about how difficult she found it to be the primary earner and the and the struggles she's had being a parent and how that impacts her relationship with her partner and how she's raising her child in a sort of gender neutral way and not revealing the baby's sex. It's, yeah, she's very, very open and really quite interesting. And
yeah,
she's obviously like,
so,
she's very quirky as well, isn't she?
Yeah, and actually I think you might enjoy listening to it because she talks about how she's become totally obsessed with cooking for her baby, and she talks about how she's bought a muffin.
God, the weaning days are 3 weeks away from
are they?
Me. Yeah, I just bought some books because I don't have an effing clue. I just feel like I can't give her baked beans, so I need to do some homework.
I think that that's a phase you might really enjoy. Sarah, one of my best friends with my goddaughter, who's one now, she said that she actually loved when Sienna started weaning because she was like, food, I understand. Do you know what I mean? I know what to give her. I know what she wants. I know what she... I can tell when she finds something tasty and when she doesn't. It's kind of... It, like, helps with another layer of communication between you and the baby.
I did buy 19 different flavours of Ella's Kitchen purees from Ocado this week. And I thought she can try one a day for 19 days and
like
see what the hell she likes.
Like chef's tasting. Like
yeah, she can have an Ella's Kitchen tasting banquet. They look quite good.
Well, what Paloma Faith said is she's become obsessed with having these muffin trays and then cooking everything in miniature. So she'll put like lasagnas and make like 50 tiny lasagnas and freeze them, whatever. Anyway, love that. Also, Adam Buxton was their first live episode at Latitude and it's just the nuttiest old episode. It's funny, but I do feel for Lenny.
Did you see him?
No, I didn't see him. I was gone that day. That was the Sunday I had to leave. But listening back to it, basically they get him on and he just doesn't give a shit about food. He's just not a foodie. He's a really fussy eater. He doesn't really know how to kind of talk about food. So at one point he just starts throwing cherry tomatoes at audience members, which was very funny. Although I don't know if Jesse and Lenny, they say we'll have him round for dinner again. I also listened to an excellent archive episode of WTF with Mark Maron, in which he interviews Jason Segel, which was recommended by friend of the High Lows, Laura Snapes. It's a really funny, very open, quite emotionally vulnerable interview. He talked about his alcoholism in great depth, which I haven't heard him speak about before. He talks about aging. He talks about success and failure. But the clip that I'm going to play, just because it made me laugh so much, is when he talks about growing up as the only Jew in his school. And here he talks about when his teacher asked him to give a mortifying assembly to explain what his bar mitzvah was to all the students.
The headmaster came up and he said, "You know, everyone is very excited about your big party, but the kids don't really know what a bar mitzvah is. Would you stand up in front of the school at communion and explain what a bar mitzvah is?" So then you cut to the next day, little 13-year-old Jason Segel standing there like, "On Saturday, I become a man." And it's literally a direct cut to getting punched in the face. I mean, it's not right. How you want to do it.
I would also like to talk about an opportunity in theatre that I think might appeal to some Hilo listeners. It is the Florence Kleiner Bursary, which is a new scheme offered by the Old Vic Theatre for emerging female directors who live outside of London. So Florence Kleiner was a great friend of mine who I wrote about in my book, and I actually dedicated the book to. She was passionate about theatre and good directing and good writing. She was a brilliant, brilliant writer. In fact, the section of my book that's often most shared on social media, which makes me so happy, is a passage that she wrote that I quoted in my chapter about her. And she sadly died when she was 19. And her family have set up this fund in her memory, which will give a bursary to allow someone outside of London to come and work for a year at the Old Vic. And I just think it's such a wonderful opportunity because I was so lucky growing up that I had parents who lived in the suburbs of London. So I could go and do these placements in magazines or at newspapers, and I could always go home and live with my mum and dad. But for a lot of people, that isn't an option if they live outside of London. So this £12,000 bursary will encompass a year-long attachment to the Old Vic, beginning with the recipient's appointment as Bayliss Assistant Director to Emma Rice on the upcoming production of Wise Children. And then throughout the year, they will receive mentoring, invitations to networks to make contacts with like-minded theatre makers, production workshops, and opportunities to assist on other productions. The bursary will run from September 2018 to August 2019. And as I say, they hope it will allow an emerging female director to take up a position at the Old Vic who, due to financial barriers or other socioeconomic factors, would not ordinarily seek out the role. The deadline was actually last week, but they said if you're interested in the role, just to get in touch ASAP. We'll link to the information page in the show notes.
That sounds brilliant. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Pandora, what have you been imbibing culturally this week?
I have been watching and really enjoying Sharp Objects, which is a 8-part drama. I've watched 4 episodes so far on Sky Atlantic, starring Amy Adams. It just shows like the fact that all of A-list Hollywood are now doing, you know, the small screen. There's such power now in telly, and we're so lucky to be able to consume it. Sharp Objects is a novel by Gillian Flynn, who also famously wrote Gone Girl. I actually think Sharp Objects is a lot better as a book than Gone Girl. It's really dark, and that has been parlayed into a really sort of claustrophobic, beautiful but sickly drama. It's really, really powerful and quite kind of terrifying in a really clever way. So if you're looking for a really great new thriller, that's just absolutely brilliant on Sky Atlantic. Amy Adams is really good. Sporting cast are really good. I'd actually forgotten what happened in the book, so I'm kind of enjoying it fresh. As you may know, I love short stories, and I've been enjoying 2 different anthologies of short stories this week, and I just bought loads more for my holiday, including one that I saw reviewed in the Observer's review magazine called Caroline's Bikini, which I'm quite excited about. I read Paris for One by Jojo Moyes, who wrote the bestseller trilogy that started with Me Before You, that was made into a film. I absolutely loved them. They're really gentle, but I don't use that word to mean that they are bad. There's something really, really empowering about a read which just makes you feel kind of warm and positive and loved from the inside. And I think Jojo Moyes is really brilliant at writing those tales about women for women. I've actually got it here for you, Dolly.
I'd love to read it. Because, you know, I think that it's far harder to capture happiness than it is sadness.
Yes.
And actually, that's something they taught me. I did a creative writing module at university, and I always remember they said, the way the human brain works is we hold on to the vivid nature of sadness so easily, whereas happiness is so much harder to capture, which is why Richard Curtis is the most successful writer of our time. So I hate when people are snooty about those kind of stories.
Yeah, I find that extraordinary. It's the same way that people are snooty, quote unquote, as Meg Wolitzer called it, about the domestic novel, and actually relationships and their dynamics are one of the hardest things to write
to
about.
To capture, exactly.
It's a really, really lovely anthology of short stories. I whizzed through that, and I think you'll really enjoy Doll. I also liked, on a completely different note, a satirical book of short stories called American Housewives, which just absolutely skewers that desperate housewives, you know, suburban, quite miserable, waspy woman. They're by Helen Ellis, and they are really funny and snappy and kind of sour in the bestest way. So really enjoyed both of those, and hopefully I will be reading some more short stories soon to recommend you. I also read a book this week for a piece I'm writing that, and I say this with no hyperbole, has changed my life. I have never read a book like this. Have you ever read a book where you can't sit down? You're like too agitated, but in a good way. I was pacing this room whilst reading it. It's called Fight Like a Girl, and it's by a journalist and activist, an Australian journalist and activist called Clementine Ford. And it's about harnessing your kind of female rage, and it talks all about the things that women have to be angry for. But that makes it sound like it's a really, I don't know, woe is us kind of book. And it's just, I can't really explain how brilliant it is. I shared a passage on my Instagram that I loved, and I got so many notifications saying that, you know, other people had shared it and tagged me in it. And there was one bit I wanted to read, Dolly, because I know you will absolutely love this, about female friendships. I love the company of women. Given a choice, I probably value it more than the company of men. But where once no one batted an eyelid when I said the same thing of male friendship, now I'm made to feel strange or hostile when the situation is reversed. Being effusive about my fondness for women turns me into a man-hater or a shrew. Some people treat me with suspicion or feel the need to urge me to reconsider. I'm entreated to admit that men are wonderful, even when the only thing I've said is that I think women are great. Even the act of asking a man not to just assume he can join a group of women is seen as subversive. as if we only come to life when a man is there to talk to us. In fact, it's my experience that women are more likely to shrink than we are to expand when men are present. It's brilliant.
That's a wonderful passage.
Yeah, I think you'd love it. Another agenda-challenging woman who I really admire, especially in her new, very surprising capacity as like an A-list actor in Hollywood, is Jameela Jamil, who was interviewed by Hadley Freeman in The Guardian. So obviously we know her as like a T4 presenter. She is now living in Hollywood, starring in one of their biggest sitcoms at the moment called The Good Place. So she's had this complete second oeuvre. And Hadley Freeman interviewed her for The Guardian, and I always really admire what she says, whether it's about refusing to be retouched, Kim Kardashian's diet lollies, her fluctuating weight and how the paparazzi have treated her and how other people have responded to her. And she talks a lot about Me Too, and she says in this piece, she has a good friend called Danielle Bernfield, a movie executive who was assaulted by the actor Emile Hirsch in 2015. Hirsch was given a fine and sentenced to 15 days in jail. But he's never stopped working, says Jameela. Meanwhile, my friend has PTSD. He's now making Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Quentin Tarantino's film about the Charles Manson murders. A film about the death of a woman, directed by a man who has admitted he knew that Harvey Weinstein assaulted women, co-starring a man who assaulted a woman. And she says, it's so dark. How dare any of the people involved in that movie wear Time's Up pins to the Golden Globes? Mm. Can people just not hire men who have almost killed women? And I think that
really... I mean, well done her for saying that.
Yeah, she said...
Because it's actually very, very rare that someone that entrenched in Hollywood has the guts to say that.
Well, the headline of this piece, which is a quote from her, is, I don't want to be a double agent in the patriarchy. She says, I would rather lose the position I'm in than do it and not say how I feel.
A clever woman. That's such a clever line.
And I think just her saying that, and like you say, that's brave to kind of say, by the way, my friend and Emile Hirsch, and, you know, say all those various things.
Yes, exactly, to name people. And that will blacklist her.
But it also just shows how, I didn't even know that Emile Hirsch was guilty of that. And it shows how little has changed. And it reminds me a bit of when Roman Polanski was sitting front row, and there were all those other people accused of sexual assault sitting front row at the recent fashion shows that we talked about on the high-low. So anyway, I loved that interview. I think she's a really cool woman, and I like her so much more the more I read, you know, about her and the things she has to say. Lastly, it's Breastfeeding Awareness Week, and there is a brilliant documentary by the journalist Kate Quilton, who I am lucky enough to be on a baby WhatsApp group with. And she's made a documentary all about breastfeeding and why it's so political, and why we still, even though it's legal to breastfeed anywhere you want in public, it's still such a contentious issue. A woman was recently chucked out of Claridge's for breastfeeding there. I haven't managed to watch it yet, so it's a recommendation for myself as much as for all you guys. But I think it's a really vital topic. It's definitely a feminist topic, and it's one that I think for a lot of women, until you have a baby and breastfeed, you can't understand the enormity of this act and that relationship, and how difficult it is to establish your milk flow, and how hard it is to have other people shaming you for feeding somewhere or telling you can't feed somewhere. And the whole thing is mired in stress and a lack of real understanding. And another really brilliant thing for Breastfeeding Awareness Week is a special episode of the Get It Off Your Breasts podcast with Liana Bird, Clemency Burton Hill, and Kate Quilton. Again, they are also all women on my baby WhatsApp group. So well done, girls, for your breastfeeding content this week. It's a really, really good listen, especially if you've just had a baby. They are so eloquent, and you'll feel really kind of empathised and loved afar by these women and what they're discussing. Obviously, this might not be particularly interesting if you've just had a baby. It also might be quite hard to listen to it and to watch it if you can't breastfeed. Like I said, it's a very political subject. There's kind of criticism around bottle feeding as much so as around breastfeeding, which is why I actually don't talk about my own personal experiences, because they are personal and they are mine. But there's a really shocking statistic, and I don't think any of us would have suspected this, that only 1% of women are still breastfeeding when their baby is 6 months old. And that is the lowest stat in the entire world. in the whole world, and you think how privileged our country is, and it's because there's just been an absolute lack of support and emphasis. So for all the people who are saying, you know, the breastfeeding Nazis, these people who insist on trying to make women breastfeed, they're not trying to do that. They're trying to really help in a field that has been desperately neglected in women's health for a really long time. So I welcome this documentary and this podcast, and for any women to feel like they're getting the support they need.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
From titties to the top line. Take it away, Panda.
The Swedish royal family's crown jewels have been stolen from a cathedral by two suspects who escaped by speedboat. The priceless jewels were taken from Strängnäs Cathedral in southeastern Sweden, where they had been on display. A couple from Leeds who tricked their 17-year-old daughter into a forced marriage have been jailed for 8 years in Bangladesh. The incident occurred in 2016 while the family were on holiday, and the teenage girl contacted the British High Commission, who collaborated with Bangladeshi authorities to bring her safely back to the UK. Labour have come under criticism yet again for anti-Semitism after it was announced that a second member of their party is now under investigation for criticising Labour's controversial move to rewrite the definition of anti-Semitism, which is a hugely sensitive topic. Ian Austin, the MP for Dudley North, whose parents were Jewish refugees, was sent a letter warning him that he was being investigated for abusive conduct in Parliament after he expressed anger over Labour's new code. A woman with two wombs has given birth to twins in what doctors describe as a 1 in 500 million birth. Jennifer Ashford has a rare heart-shaped uterus, which means that twins Poppy and Piran House grew entirely separately with their own amniotic sacs and placentas. An app nicknamed Tinned Ra has come under fire for rating public schools according to the best-looking pupils. Toffee, which costs £4.99 and was launched in April, puts pupils of Marlborough School as the most attractive, followed by Uppingham and Wellington. The founder admits that the app is not everyone's cup of tea, but that she is simply trying to bring people together from a similar background. Mental health sufferers will now be able to get a disabled parking permit. The blue badge will extend to those experiencing extreme psychological distress and is hoped to help those with hidden disabilities such as autism, dementia, depression and severe learning difficulties. 103 people managed to escape from a plane which crashed and caught fire after taking off in a blustery storm. Survivors said the Embraer 190 plane smashed down into a nearby field but skidded to a stop virtually intact before bursting into flames. Officials said 49 people had been taken to hospital, most with minor injuries. All passengers are expected to live. Women across Denmark will protest on the streets wearing niqabs and burqas in defiance of a new law banning them from wearing face veils. The Danish government introduced the new law, which came into effect on Wednesday of this week, that prevents people from wearing the garment in public places. The government argues that the veil is strongly oppressive, whilst detractors have said that it is discriminatory against a minority group. A new government bill in France is set to make catcalling illegal after a 22-year-old woman was slapped in the face for telling a man who was wolf-whistling and making lewd comments at her to shut up. The video went viral this week. The bill, which is thought to be introduced this autumn, will impose fines for anyone who is annoying, following and threatening a woman. French Equalities Minister Marlene Schiappa said she was outraged but unfortunately not surprised about the incident. Blue wine is now a thing. Vindingo uses a pigment in the grape skin to achieve its electric blue colouring. Around 35,000 bottles of Vindingo are now on sale in France, but its entrepreneurial founder says he has plans to take his crop to the wine capital of Bordeaux. The wine apparently has a fruity taste with cherry, passion fruit and blackberry. And that was the top line. Stop,
related to Tindra.
I'd never heard of it.
Which I think might tickle you.
Are you on it, Dolly?
No. When I was at a mixed boarding school, there was a thing that there was like a bar on site that we all used to go to. And at the end of the year, it was only the sixth formers went to this bar, obviously. Otherwise, that would be inappropriate, wouldn't it? 16-year-olds and above only going to drink at school. There was this thing called Last Chance Bar, where everyone leaving in the upper sixth, the lower sixth would write down anyone who they wanted to get off with at the bar, at the last bar. And then,
is this a school or is this an 18 to 36 club, I ask you?
I'd be amazed if this still exists at rugby now. And then the upper sixth would write down who they wanted to get off with. And then there was this horrible, horrible moment where we were all in boarding houses, like Harry Potter. And the morning of Last Chance Bar, this sort of Cupid would come and deliver notes saying who your like matches were, if anyone had matches to like set you up to have a snog that evening at bar. I wrote down every single boy's name in upper sixth. Every single boy in my year. Do you know how many matches I got?
I feel like you're going to say none. One. I love that this is your contribution to Tindra, not just a slightly sad story of your youth, but also my...
That is Tindra, basically.
My Catholic single-sex boarding school self would have been so fucking jealous of everything you just said.
Not if you looked like me when you were 17, trust
me. Da, 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 da. Ladies and gentlemen, our 29-year-old virgin. Jane Garvey announced on Radio 4's Women's Hour this week that "Hey guys" is never an appropriate greeting for a group of people that includes women. She said you should group men and women as "Hi people" and that "Hi guys" was only okay for a daringly informal guest speaker at the annual meeting of the Society of People Named Guys. Thoughts, Doll?
I think this is something that my dad would say, and I think this is more about a generational difference when it comes to formality and informality than it is about gender. Guys is something my mum says all the time, and I often see my dad flinch when she says it, and it's because she's Canadian. And I do think it's just, it's an Americanism, really, which means that there's an implied kind of familiar register. And I think that's probably the thing that's bothering her more than the gender thing. But I don't know Jane Garvey personally, but that's just a hunch that I have.
The Times have called it a feminist backlash, which seems slightly mock incendiary. My favourite comment under the Times article online is from Hutcho, who says, "Might be best not to talk to women at all. It seems to be a bit dangerous whatever you do or say, however innocent." An absolute classic, that comment.
You see that comment
wheeled out again and again. I personally don't have any truck with "Hi guys." I don't find it anti-feminist. I think it's slang, and I actually think it's quite inclusive slang. Mm. I think "guys" is gender neutral, and why can't a guy be a girl? It's pretty unisex. If we can have big dick energy, we can be a guy. And I'd actually argue that we can be a dude too.
I say dude. I also say man quite a lot. And I said it to someone quite official the other day, and I don't think she liked it. I saw in her eyes that she didn't like it. And I forgot that it's just the way that me and a lot of my friends address each other. And I think maybe she just found it odd. I think she maybe thought I was like, "Hey man." I mean, I don't know why I said it. Even as I said that, I don't know why I said it to someone official. I think she found it very strange.
Yeah, that one's probably a bit more problematic. And we'll park your inappropriate greeting for another story in another day. The etymology of "guy" is actually quite interesting. I'd assumed, like you mentioned earlier, it was just an adopted Americanism for us, but according to my research, Google, it was originally an eponym for Guy Fawkes, so you burn a guy or an effigy, and it was first used for a group of men in 1867 before becoming a gender-neutral plural used by teenagers in the 80s, though of course that's less substantiated. I know you're with me on this, Doll. The alternatives to "guys" are quite dire. There isn't a single easy, friendly, informal way to address a group of men and women together. There's "Hey friends," which I've used before and feels a bit odd and serial killery.
Weird.
There's "Hey folks," which makes it sound like I'm trying to be Keith Urban. It comes accompanied with a Stetson and a pair of cowboy boots, which is a bit embarrassing when you're from Colchester.
"Hey folks" is horrible. "Hey cats," you could try. You could bring it back. "Hey cats, hey hep cats."
What's a hep cat?
It's just like a sort of like 50s jazz term, which is I really think of.
Okay, let's try Hepcats.
Hey, Hepcats.
To be honest, it isn't even about mixed sex parties. When I'm emailing women, I still opt for guys. It doesn't particularly infuriate me when I'm called a girl in the way I know it does some, though it does call to mind Britney singing I'm a girl, not yet a woman. But I do see how it can be a bit infantilizing in the way that I find women addressing a group of grown men as the boys is both sort of sexually coy and performatively innocent. It's also very traditional and binary in the idea that, like, the boys retire to the drawing room for, like, whiskey whilst the women stay in the kitchen tidying up. I absolutely abhor ladies. I find it really middle tier management on a Friday night. It's really passive aggressive. Anytime we get an email that begins, hey ladies, I die a bit inside and can't read the rest. It's actually very triggering for me, and I use that in a satirical sense. Please don't troll me.
Pandora's been triggered, Charlie. Can you see to Pandora? We had some hysterical woman email into the Hilo once saying that she was turning off because she found it so offensive and patronising that we often refer to women, particularly our female friends, as girls.
Well, maybe it's something I've only recently stopped doing then. I must have done that a lot for her to get so cross with us.
She was really angry about it. And I have to say, I did not cry into my pillow that night knowing that we'd lost her as a listener, because I really like calling my friends girls. I think that a man constantly addressing a group of women as girls is irritating, as it's loaded with context and it's very barbed. But I think me calling my closest friend girls is tied up in the fact that to me, whether we're 15 or 50, we always feel like little kids. So I really like calling them girls because it kind of is in tune with how childish we are with each other. And it actually always warms my heart when I meet women in their 60s or 70s and they talk about their girls. I think it's something really evergreen and lovely about that.
Well, maybe I should bring it back again. What about hey ladies?
Oh.
The hey ladies email is now legendary. I mentioned it on the Hilo, I think it was in April, after two American writers named Caroline Moss and Michelle Markowitz wrote an epistolary novel based around these eight best friends who use WhatsApp threads and email chains and group text messages, which all pivot around that prototypical hey ladies format, which means it will involve a Google Cal scheduling error, a ton of exclamation points and a request for $60 by the time you reach the end of that email. There's something about hey ladies email which means you feel on the verge of a panic attack and always owing money. I think hey ladies is the stuff of hens and inflatable flamingo nightmares, as well as the middle management Friday night. Incidentally, I really want to read that book. It got a great write-up, as it were, on Call Your Girlfriend and New York Mag's website, The Cut.
It's very true, and I think that's correct as to why the minute I see hey ladies pop up in my WhatsApp messages or on my emails, it does fill me with such dread.
Jane Garvey's suggestion that we should all enter a bar and holler, hey people, is one of those suggestions that seems perfect on paper and it's like, you know, very sort of PC, but it's actually the stuff of nightmares if used in a practical sense. I can almost imagine an entire bar shuddering to silence when I attempted that. You know, is this debate all a bit of a middle class eye roll, or is it of genuine feminist importance as much as a unisex gender neutral loo is? I just can't decide if I think it's something we should progress on, but then maybe I'm biased because all the alternatives make me want to heave. I wonder if I'm going to be forced to simply saying hello rather ominously to a collective gathering and then nothing further.
Luckily, I'm very rarely in a mixed gang of people because I don't work in an office. I work from home and I'm also a bit of a loner. So it's not something I have to think about too much, how I address them.
Slate wrote a pretty persuasive piece back in 2016 about this, with the slug being how gender neutral really is the term guys. And it argued that guys has a male as default paradigm. Though it also suggested that if we talk to kids with guys, meaning both men and women, that could shift with permanence. Language, as we all know, is evolutionary and constantly in flux. There'll be some people who have a more progressive approach and some people who are helmed to tradition. But here at the Hilo, we're team hey guys and hey girls. Sorry, Jane.
In today's second topic, we want to talk about bad jokes and specifically how much they should define us. Last week, South African comedian and talk show host Trevor Noah was forced to defend himself when an offensive joke about Aboriginal women made during a stand-up comedy show in 2013 resurfaced on social media. The clip, which has since been removed from YouTube, sees the comedian begin by saying, "All women of every race can be beautiful," and I know some of you are sitting there now going, "Oh, Trevor, yeah, but I've never seen a beautiful Aborigine." It's not always about looks. Noah then acts out playing a didgeridoo in a suggestive manner. Many of those who criticised the clip were Australian, where Noah is heading next month for a comedy tour. Some called for a boycott of the shows and also acknowledged that Noah had not expressly apologised for the joke.
This was brought to my attention by one of my favourite podcasts, The Week Unwrapped, who discussed it on this week's show. I want to insert a clip here of the team discussing it because I think their argument is quite foundational to any discussion being had about it.
The mechanic that he was using to get to the punchline was bad taste and something he shouldn't have said, but there was a mechanic. But there was a punchline, which, again, difficult to say on the show, was about filleting a didgeridoo, which arguably, you know, as a comedian, I can sort of understand why he would, you know, he's come up with a punchline and how do I get there? And this is 4 or 5 years later. Mm. And it's not inconsistent, is it, for him to say, I now regret doing that, yeah. but at the time it felt like a reasonable thing to do. And it's revisionism to say it didn't happen.
I think there are two topics to discuss here. The first is comedy and the second is shaming. Both are topics that are really on my mind at the moment. I think what comedy is and where it's going is something that's being examined right now, and rightly so. I think the discussion is splintering. Hannah Gadsby and Nanette show one side of that discussion, which is that comedy should be progressive and a tool for change. And then there's another camp that is voicing fears that our focus on inclusivity should not bleed so much into comedy that it negates the integrity or the truth or the expression of the material.
It's very much becoming polarised in the Hannah Gadsby and Nanette camp. I mean, I do find myself thinking time and time again about the concept of women parlaying their pain into a joke, the relief of tension, the onus on the marginalised community, whether that's women or more specifically in Hannah's case, lesbians, or I'm sure many other marginalised communities feel like that.
In truth, I'm interested by both sides of the argument, and I think the key is that there should be room for both. Mm. I had an interesting debate with a friend over the weekend, actually, who said that she's not interested in comedy that's purely catharsis for the storyteller. And as you mentioned, it was in relation to Hannah Gadsby's theory that self-deprecating humour doesn't help oppressed communities. And I have to say, I do disagree with that, because I think that there should be enough space for comedy that is supposedly wallowing and cathartic, and also comedy that is more demonstratively active in its protest for change.
I also think that if we don't allow art to be catharsis, then why should we expect people to bother making it?
Yes,
you know, why shouldn't they be allowed to be rewarded for their kind of, you know, work that they've done.
Yeah, because some people will be pioneers of change, some artists, but some people won't.
Yeah.
And I think what I believe now is that we should enter a world where all is legitimate and there's equal space for both.
I think if we subscribe to the notion that everything we do should serve the greater good and can't, say, be beneficial to us just on a singular level, well, then I think we're all a bit fucked, especially given that we are products of neoliberalism, which places like the self and the singular at the very kind of forefront of social politics, actual politics, economics. I would warrant that what your friend is espousing would just function as a tool to self-silence out of fear of not speaking with... out of fear of not speaking with everything we say to the masses.
And also, it never really is a singular experience, because the whole point of when you share those stories, be it in a self-deprecating
way, other people see them reflected.
Exactly. And there's a moment of release in that for those who identify, whether it offers a solution of how to change or not. What I do think is that a joke can only ever be made at the expense of the person making it or punching upwards. For me, that's just a foundational rule of comedy, as it is for most people, which is why Trevor Noah's joke is so obviously unacceptable.
That's a really good term you said there, punching upwards rather than punching down. I can totally see what you mean by that. It's a really interesting one, and it's quite complicated, this, because I really admire a lot of what Trevor Noah does, and his story and how he came to have the incredibly powerful job he has in America is one of kind of real determination. He grew up under apartheid in South Africa. The fact that he became the host of The Daily Show, previously helmed by Jon Stewart, a show that goes out to the very conservative, very old school, like hugely mainstream America, is no mean feat as both a man that grew up under apartheid in South Africa and a black man. He's not some, you know, white dickhead who's completely unself-aware and has never had any kind of trauma in his life making these cruel jokes. But whose mouth the joke is from is important. It doesn't make it okay, but I think it does reframe it. For instance, he got in trouble recently for congratulating the French football team on winning the World Cup and, you know, saying, well, it's as much a win for Africa as it is for France because a lot of the French team are black men. People complained about this, saying that he was denying the French team their Frenchness. And his response was, I am actually merely including myself in their Africanness. And I found that really interesting. I could completely see what he was trying to do. He was actually trying to be inclusive, not exclusive. But the didgeridoo joke, of course, punching down, as you say, is a completely different kettle of fish. But as Ollie Mann said on The Week Unwrapped, you have to hope when you tell a joke and it's crass and it dates quite quickly or was never really appropriate in the first place, but it was a different climate and a different audience, the audience won't judge you forever on it and that they will understand that, like them, you have grown up and wouldn't make the same joke now. Yes. And as Ollie said, which I think was really interesting, it's rarely your audience and your fans and your followers that are offended by that joke you made in the past.
Yes.
It's people who aren't perhaps a fan of your work, aren't familiar with it and haven't grown with you. It's
coming to it out of context.
Because I think it used to be that, like, comedians, you know, they had their fan base and that's what mattered. Whereas now it feels like every comedian has to be everything to everyone, which is the problem I think we have with things in general.
I recently wrote a piece about the future of comedy for the Sunday Times Style, and my conclusion was this. I think the only thing that truly determines what is acceptable with comedy, what's funny and what isn't, what is hurtful and what isn't, and what those boundaries are, is time. I think that's the determiner. I think we forget how quickly our collective appetite for comedy changes. If you look at how so many of Generation Z just totally do not understand why millennials and Generation X found Friends funny for all those years, or look at how our generation and Generation X don't understand how our parents and grandparents laughed at bloody Bernard Manning jokes, look at how ubiquitous minstrel shows were. And really, not that long ago, the people who made these jokes or laughed at these jokes were not fundamentally bad people. They were uninformed people who would, I'm sure, many of them, in the context of present day and knowing everything we know and hearing the stories we've heard, would be appalled that they ever found this funny. I'm not saying...
Well, can I just insert here that Punch and Judy is a man beating up his wife?
Yeah.
The, like, most loved puppet show of all time. Gets pretty depressing when you start going through everything that was enjoyed.
Yeah, and I think... I'm not saying that Trevor Noah's joke was akin to that level of sort of ancient ignorance. It's telling that the reason he stopped it is that an Australian audience member apparently had to spell it out for him that it was offensive. But what I do think is apparent is that we're in a time of enormous social change and social awareness, which Pandora and I constantly talk about, we think is a wonderful thing. But it does mean that our comedy, our TV shows and our art is going to start dating very quickly.
I have to say, I'm very cautious of revisionism. It's happening with history and literature a lot at the moment. I think it was just last week or the week before, If, the very famous poem by Rudyard Kipling, was scrubbed off the wall at Manchester University because his work was written from a colonial perspective. And of course, with Friends and Sex and the City, and people saying these shows wouldn't get made now, of course they wouldn't. Neither probably would Cheers and Frasier and Monty Python and all those much-loved series.
I think the question of revisionism is interesting. I remember you and I had a chat a while back off the back of a top line news story, which was that an Italian opera house had changed the ending of Carmen with new feminist agenda so that it didn't end with a woman dying at the hand of a man. I think this is really powerful, particularly when violence against women is still so ubiquitous. However, I would also say it would be a great shame if that revised ending of Carmen was then made into the default ending for all productions. I don't think telling that original story is about glorifying violence against women. I think it's about telling the truth. And the truth of the past is uncomfortable sometimes, but it's so, so important. It's crucial for our understanding of ourselves collectively and historically. And it's crucial for making sure that we progress, I think. And we can't rub out history for not being palatable enough for our modern palates.
That really brings to mind Nancy being murdered by Bill Sykes in Oliver. You know, that was such a powerful story in my childhood. Would we erase that? I think that, as you say, that really reflects a kind of truth in Victorian times.
Yeah, and exactly.
Domestic abuse. To bring it back to the didgeridoo, Trevor Noah was a man making a joke about marginalised people knowing how to give good fellatio. It's gross, especially as Aboriginal women face so much discrimination in Australia. He might not have known about this. And of course, the argument is then, well, do your research and then see whether or not your joke is sort of like a bit off colour or ragingly offensive. Mm-hmm. But the controversial talking point in Australia, and it has been a talking point for a few years, is the very sad story of an Aborigine woman named Lynette Daly who was raped and killed, and yet the suspected killers 5 years on have still not been on trial. If it was two Indigenous people who'd done it to a white girl, they'd be in jail, her stepfather, Gordon Davis, said. Clementine Ford's book that I mentioned earlier, Fight Like a Girl, talks a lot about it, because she is Australian and she writes, you know, a lot about that kind of specific context, and how marginalised and how badly treated Aboriginal women are, and also the health issues and just like education, basically, and information. We just don't, as non-Australian people, I just don't think we are aware of actually how horrific a lot of the surrounding context is. And actually, a lot of people in Australia either don't know or care. And that's Clementine's issue. So for Trevor Noah to make a joke based on that, based on what happened to Lynette Daly, for Trevor to make a joke about this Indigenous community, which
to
is
a probably so, very ignorant audience,
which is so badly treated and neglected historically and still in modern life, is really rank.
And what's interesting about the Trevor Noah joke is that I've read differing reports, but from as far as I can see, he's not properly apologised, which I am surprised by. For me, this is not a joke that warrants this man's life being ruined or his career being cancelled or all his shows being boycotted. But I do think there's no way of reasoning your way out of this joke. He's laughing at two oppressed communities of which he's not a part of. And beyond that, he's assessing and mocking women's physical appearance in a way that's not even amusing.
Trevor has said that some jokes don't translate and that this joke is one of them. He also suggested rather weakly that some people find some stuff funny and others don't. Although I have seen him on his Twitter replying to lots of angry Australians who have been like, well, you know, why don't you come here and educate yourself? Or why don't you come? I think there was some museum or foundation, you know, to do with education of Aborigines and the history of Aborigines. And he said, yeah, you know, I'd love to come visit your area and perhaps you could show me. So I don't think it's perhaps as kind of awful as maybe these media storms.
Yeah, his reaction.
Yeah, his reaction is maybe not necessarily as belligerent as we might think. But it's a learning curve to all, really, is do your research before making a joke. But then, of course, like you say, that does raise the argument about comedy and the role of provocation and PC-dom, doesn't it? Maybe Trevor felt like he was allowed to make a joke like that because he grew up as a marginalised individual in South Africa. He had to overcome so much to be the successful comedian and talk show host he is now, to even get to America. But then to flip that back, does one marginalised community get to make jokes about another, especially when one is male and the other is female, and so on and so forth? I don't know, to be honest. I don't know if you can equate the two. It is certainly not like a white man making a joke about a marginalised community. No, the context is different.
Yeah, and I do think that's a really interesting point that you raised, and I do think it's clumsy. You know, I take enormous offence when I hear misogynist jokes come out of the mouth of gay men. For me, that's...
They feel like maybe...
That's totally different. You know, it's totally different experiences, and I think that to conflate the two and believe that one can punch down to the other, I think that's problematic.
Yeah,
the comedian Shappy Korsandi wrote a piece for The Independent titled "Why It's Wrong to Call Out People Like Trevor Noah for the Off-Colour Jokes They Made in the Past."
Wrong title.
In it, she says, "I have said jokes in the past which I no longer like or stand by. Every comedian has. Comedy is like an iceberg, constantly moving forward, and you have to move with it if you want your audiences to continue to relate to you. I may have moved on from those jokes, but I am not ashamed that I ever made offensive jokes. It's how I found my persona and how I learned to read the room."
Interesting.
"Sometimes when you're on stage, very politically incorrect things come out of your mouth. In this job, it takes a hell of a lot of time, experience, and self-awareness to be able to trust and act on instincts without being a slave to fear. Even then, you can still misjudge. If even after a comic has apologised," which Shappy says Noah did a long time before the footage of this routine was unearthed, "if you still decide that one routine or one joke is the sum total of who they are, rather than putting up with stand-up comedy, you'd better off just sticking with bingo."
That's really true. That's like someone listening to The Hilo and disagreeing with one thing we say and saying, well, I'm never listening to them again. Mm. Or someone reading a piece we've written and saying, I'm never going to read that writing again.
Well, I just think it cuts you off from a great many experiences and thoughts and lines of debate. What I'm saying is this: if this is one thing that you disagree with and the rest of someone's work you found interesting, well, obviously you don't have to listen to someone.
This is what I think is interesting, is the rest of his work is like really quite impressive, especially given what I've said of what he'd necessarily overcome to get there. I think that piece by Chappie is really interesting. It's written by a woman and a woman of colour about a black man, and I actually think that's something important to note. It's not a white male comic writing in defence of another white male comic.
I think, as Chappie Called Sandy says in her piece, and as we touched on last week, in fact, it's important to remember that we are so much more than our worst comment or our worst stand-up routine or our worst day. And I think sometimes, particularly online, we have to think about how life pans out and how conversation pans out when you're sitting in a social situation. Sometimes you just say something that's wrong. I know I certainly have. I've misjudged a room or a group, or I've been in a strange mood, or I've felt tired, or I've felt sort of insecure, and I say something that just doesn't land. It's exactly the same in the online world. If someone made an offensive joke at a dinner table that was hugely out of character for them, we would not march them out of our house and tell them to go sit in a dark, locked room for months on end and never dare get in touch with us again. We'd say to them, hey, that's not cool, and then we'd move on. I once heard someone say, I think it was John Ronson actually on Adam Buxton, he said that our civilian policing of morality is indicative of a society trying to survive without the historic, former, rigorous and oppressive structure of religion. And I just think that's so true.
Absolutely. That's an argument I've heard before, and I'm sure we'll hear it again, and it's really interesting. I think we forget now that the role that religion has historically played at shaping and governing a society. It's like we're now in this post-agnostic moral code, and we're all sort of societally speaking, navigating the barriers and the limits. To play devil's avocado about you saying you wouldn't march someone out of a dinner party for an off-colour joke, or the bitch about them when you were doing the washing up. Trevor is making vast amounts of money based off
those
jokes.
That's true, that is
so
true.
So someone making a shit joke is only really changing the outcome of the dinner party or your personal relationship. It's not changing the kind of social structure around comedy and how Aboriginal women are thought of. I mean, like, this is the, you know, maybe this is something we should have spoken about before, but this is the first time we've spoken about how Aboriginal women are a really marginalised community and how their abuse or sexual assault is not taken seriously in Australia like it is to white women. The fact that everyone's now talking about this joke and that being their first introduction to Aboriginal women, well, does it mean they'll then go away and do more research? I don't know. I mean, there's pros and cons to this kind of thing being exposed, isn't there?
I think you're right that obviously it does entrench it in a different context when you know that that person is making money. I just think that I have said things in the past that have not been recorded that, if they were to be used as a defining yardstick for who I was, then I'd be hung. And I think, you know, my hat goes off to the person who truly believes that they don't have that in their past either. So, I don't know. You know my thoughts on this. I think we just have to be a little bit more patient with people. And I think the key is, I'm not saying I want to live in a world without consequence or without boundaries. I think our increasing awareness of the importance of sensitivity with language and how we address and speak about communities is vital. But I also just don't want to live in a world where we're always searching for evidence of someone being a bad person whose life or career should be over because of a misjudged comment. It's important that the mistake is highlighted. Certainly, it's important it's highlighted publicly. It's important the person recognises where they've slipped up. And it's important that they apologise. But then I think it's important we learn and we move on. And that, for me, is progression. In the summertime, when the weather is high, you can stretch right up and touch the sky.
When the weather's fine, you got women on your mind. The Hilo is now taking a summer break to don a sombrero, drink pina coladas and read 487 books, which we'll be sure to tell you about when we're back, which is on the 6th of September. We will not be replying to emails, tweets. Please don't leave an Instagram message asking when we're coming back again, because I'm telling you right now, babes, we're coming back on the 6th of September.
Also, just a final note, I've been getting a lot of emails about, do I have the link for this? What was the episode of that I recommended?
And show notes!
One show final notes! Time. Girlfriend just needs to check the show notes, okay? Girlfriend just needs to check the show notes. That said, we will miss you all. And also, I like that you mentioned a woman wearing a sombrero, because incidentally, I've already formatted my out of office, and that is the picture. So Pandora is off to play with her baby.
And Dolly is off to play with herself.
And Charlie is off to play with his award-winning marrows.
Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe on iTunes. You can email us thehiloshow@gmail.com. We won't reply because we're on holiday. You can tweet us @thehiloshow. We won't reply there either. Oh, and also, if you want to hear how overexcited Dolly got that we are almost on our summer break, just listen to the end of the jingle at the end of the podcast to hear what happened when I gave her a glass of rosé. Bye-bye.
I can't believe I've broken something.
It's all right.
I'm fucked up.
Hang on. Whoa.